Hello, America. This is the place for uncensored talk on everything that divides us as a nation. I'm Alan Jacoby, and welcome to The Great Divide. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to The Great Divide. I'm with the one and only Roger Stone again. He has joined me, the best-dressed political operative out there. And what do we know about Roger Stone? That we know Roger Stone, you look him up, he's the man that got railroaded by Robert Mueller and the DOJ, and the man that Donald Trump pardoned, and he stayed out of jail. But, like, what do we really know? I want to know things. I want people, my listeners, to know things. Roger, thanks for being here again. Thank you so much. You're great. How are you?
Great to be here. I appreciate your introduction. I'll tell you two great things about this hat. One, it is a very, very fine, very tightly woven, and at one time very expensive Panama hat. All Panama hats, by the way, the best ones are made in Ecuador, not Panama. But more importantly, I bought it in a vintage shop for a song. In any event, let's go.
That's great. Well, listen, your fashion sense is off the charts. I just recently got the book, Stone's Rules, and I'm going to have it in the show notes for everybody to get it. I read it in a day. You got some amazing stuff in that book, especially
fashion. Introduction there by Tucker Carlson, my great pal, and a truly great American.
Absolutely. So, the Roger Stone, you have been in politics probably as long as I've been alive, for 40 years. And you've done some amazing things. But this, I want to get up close and personal. I want to know the Roger Stone, your childhood, your parents, you grew up, what got you into politics. Just take us into it. Sure. What was childhood for Roger Stone like?
Well, you know, I'm a lot like my mentor, Richard Nixon, who I had the privilege to meet when I was 16 years old. I'll come to that in a moment. In that I'm not very good at being retrospective. In other words, I really don't think a lot about the past because, in fact, you can't change things in the past. Whereas I'm very, very focused on the future obviously for my wife, who, as you know, is battling stage 4 cancer, but also the future for the country, the future for our constitutional liberty. I spent 30 years in the corroded rectum of the two-party system. I've seen up close the way the sausage is made, and it isn't pretty. And that is the reality. I'm a hard-bitten, hard-boiled, experienced veteran of now 11 presidential campaigns, in which I played some central role. People don't understand that I'm also a family man, that I have a son who's a police officer. I have a daughter who's a registered nurse that works for the county. I have grandchildren that I'm extraordinarily proud of, one in Hawaii, one at college in the Midwest. One has just moved to South Carolina, my eldest granddaughter. I am blessed with a great grandson, which is the greatest thing that can ever happen. His name is Odin, and he's the most beautiful baby you've ever seen. And yes, he has a onesie that says, Roger Stone did nothing wrong.
Of course he does. Why wouldn't he? So, you grew up in Connecticut, correct?
Yes, I did. Connecticut is obviously quite different than the place that I grew up. I grew up in Fairfield County. Now, New York operates within two different media markets, meaning people in some parts, in fact, I think geographically, probably most parts of Connecticut, see Boston television or Hartford television, and they read the Boston Globe as the leading newspaper along with the Hartford Courant. Both of them leaned left then, both of them to the extent that they haven't been decimated by the decline of newspapers, lean left today. But the people in Fairfield County, in the New York City suburbs, well, we cheer for the Yankees or the Mets. We watch New York TV. We read the New York Daily News or the New York Post or the New York Times, if you're more educated or rich, as my mother would say. It is an area where you had a lot of, in the suburbs, a lot of Italian Americans, Hungarian Americans, Irish Americans, very large Catholic population, Polish, and so on. You also had a minority community, including African Americans, and at that time, Puerto Ricans. Later, you would see the influx of, you know, Asians and island peoples and so on. So, but it was a very gritty, it had both a gritty part of it, but it also had the lush country club and wealthy parts of it, like Darien, New Canaan, Greenwich, Westport, Weston, Wilton. Those, interestingly enough, were the towns in which I managed my first campaign for the state Senate. This was for a candidate named John Lupton. Actually, to be honest, I was the assistant campaign manager to a brilliant advertising man, and I actually just carried out his plan, and I learned a great deal.
Wow. I want to rewind a little bit, though, because from what I know about you and what I've seen, you in school were involved in a political campaign of sorts, correct?
That is correct. So in 1960, during the Nixon-Kennedy campaign, was the first time politics entered my subconscious. And of course, you had to notice it because it was prominent in the everyday media. And the media was much more compacted. There are only three networks on which to watch television. And then if you lived in New York, there were a handful of independents like WPIX and WNEW and so on that had also had a lot of bandwidth. In any event, we were fed a narrative about the Kennedy assassination. We were fed a narrative about any national event. But that's the first time I noticed the Nixon-Kennedy campaign. I actually didn't notice it until after the nominations, because when my sister asked me whether I was for Nixon or Kennedy, I told her I was for Lodge. And she said, no, you don't understand. The nominations were over already. It's come down to John Kennedy and Richard Nixon. Which one are you for? And I said, well, who are you for? And she said, I'm for Nixon. She was 2 years younger than me. And I said, you know what? I like Kennedy. She said, why? I said, well, he's Catholic. We're Catholic. And two, he's got better hair than Nixon. But then that's how you think when you're 12 years old, you know?
Sure. Yeah. And that prompted you to, you ran for some sort of council in grade school yourself with that election?
I did. At one point, I thought about really more symbolically challenging Nelson Rockefeller as an independent candidate for governor. That effort exploded when I found out that based on the state constitution, I was not yet old enough to be governor, but what the hey, as Milton Berle used to say. I grew up in a gritty kind of mixed politics, which was instructive because I lived in the city of Norwalk. Now, the city of Norwalk through the 60s and 70s, and maybe into the early 80s, essentially had a matching demographic for the United States. In other words, the same number of Catholics and Protestants, the same number of whites, blacks, Hispanics, and Asians, the same number of senior citizens, the same number of middle-aged locals, the same. So it was a perfect microcosm of the country. It had a growing black community. It had a growing Hispanic community. At that time, overwhelmingly Puerto Rican. Later, it would become more diverse. So if you could elect a mayor in Norwalk, Connecticut, strategically, that meant you knew how to elect a president, because it was the exact same, you know, data set, the exact same makeup of the electorate. And I learned a great deal, therefore, in local Norwalk city politics in the 60s and 70s.
And is that what kind of motivated you to get into politics yourself and get heavily involved and get involved in the Nixon campaign? Like, how did you get involved in the Nixon campaign? What motivated you?
What actually motivated me was the fact that in 1963, a neighbor woman gave me a book called The Conscience of a Conservative. It was written by Senator Barry Goldwater. It was pretty simple. It was a paperback. You know, and it was written for the average reader. And I was immediately transfixed because I liked Goldwater's message. I felt it really reflected what I already thought, meaning I wanted government to be small and inobtrusive. I wanted the maximum personal freedom to say what I want, drink what I want, smoke what I want, eat what I want, love who I want. I want the government out of my personal affairs. I want my affairs and the economy regulated as little by government as possible. I want government money to be spent wisely, not pissed away on social justice bullshit. We didn't call it that then, but that's what we meant. I wanted a national defense that was really muscular and strong, but I wanted to use it as a deterrent to trouble around the world rather than going around the world like the Bushes and the neocons, who later capture control of the Republican Party I love and use it as an international, you know, expansion as they try to liberate the world under false pretenses. So I knew that Goldwater was my early lodestar. Now, after, as you know, when you're at that point, I guess, around 12, your political realism is not that great. Right. I follow the campaign avidly, but surely the American people can see that Barry Goldwater is an honest man of quality, not the trigger-happy nut that the media tries to depict him. And Lyndon Johnson's the most obvious crook you've ever seen in your life. The published literature alone says this guy is the devil himself. I mean, he is a short-tempered. He is a vindictive. He's a pill popper. He's an alcohol. He's a heavy drinker. He's a womanizer. He is famously sadistic in driving and humiliating his own staff. Wow. He is flagrant in his the violation of his marriage vows with Lady Bird with multiple high-level women. I mean, he really is a cad as well as a criminal. That story of Johnson never really gets told until my book, The Man Who Killed Kennedy, The Case Against LBJ. So I thought, of course, my man Goldwater would win. He lost. I was crushed. After Goldwater lost, I realized that Barry had kind of gone out of his way to lost. He was kind of a grumpy guy anyway, and he had talked, you know, unfortunately, vaguely about using nuclear weapons to defoliate the jungles in Vietnam. The left winger said, "Oh my God, he wants to use nuclear weapons in Vietnam." It's not really what he said, but
right.
It was called the fake news then, I think.
There it goes, the fake news again.
pardon me for that Marco Rubio break. So I wrote a letter to Richard Nixon, who was then in exile in New York City practicing law. And I told him that my, at that point, I guess around 15-year-old study of the 1960 election had given me more than enough ample evidence that the election had been stolen from Nixon. There was a brilliant series by the New York Herald Tribune, which really drilled down and made the case and documented the theft of Illinois. By the way, you can't find it in the archives anymore. It's disappeared, but I have it as it was once originally available. That Nixon should run again. Nixon kept that letter on file for 2 years as a former vice president. I got a nice note from him. And then he invited me to New York for an interview. Now, when I showed up, I think they're expecting a much older man. They didn't really realize I was a kid. But I did manage to parlay that into a job kind of as a gopher. And that gave me a unique perspective. I got to know Pat Buchanan. I got to know most of the key people around Richard Nixon at that time, John Sears, certainly. It was a rapidly changing cast of characters because Nixon's comeback was showing great promise. But I also got to, like a backstage witness, I got to see the greats and near greats of the Republican Party come to the law office of John Mitchell, Mitchell, Mudge, Rose, Guthrie, and Alexander, the Wall Street law firm where Nixon had essentially parked. And therefore, I saw Billy Graham, and I saw Barry Goldwater, and I saw Senator Paul Fannin, and I saw Governor Tom Dewey, and I saw Governor Bill Scranton, and I saw Nelson Rockefeller, and I saw Ronald Reagan, and I saw Jimmy Stewart, and I saw Buddy Ebsen, and I saw Ginger Rogers, and I saw John Davis Lodge, and his brother Henry Cabot Lodge. I saw all of these people. I met Walt Disney, all of them coming to see Nixon's major domo, John Mitchell. It was a great experience for someone whose real job was, kid,
right,
get us some coffee. We need one black, one with cream, two of the cream has double sugar.
So you get to meet all these people, being a gopher for Nixon, at 17 years old, and then that evolved into getting involved in campaigns.
Well, I was I had the bug. I had because Goldwater lost in 64, I then immersed myself in the local campaign for mayor in 65. I supported the candidacy of the Senate Majority Leader, Louis J. Padula, a political powerhouse who was coming back to his hometown to Norwalk and run for mayor. He was very strong in Hartford. Unfortunately, he was defeated by a young, dynamic Democrat named Frank Zullo. There was a third party candidate named Jenny Cave, who was significant because she got a lot of votes. And the city of Norwalk had had a history. In the past, it had elected not only an independent mayor, but it had at one time actually elected a socialist mayor, as did the city of neighboring Bridgeport. So that is, the political milieu that I immersed myself to, meaning that the Republican lost. And that put me in a position for the first two campaigns I had worked for, had both lost. It was then that I kind of made the commitment to join the Nixon bandwagon as early as 67. Nixon begins barnstorming across the country. Nixon had done something that was extraordinarily shrewd. After losing in 1960, the truth is he dreamed of a deadlock at the 1964 convention that would turned to him as a compromise between Goldwater on the right and Rockefeller, Romney, Scranton, and the other rhinos on the left. But that was not to be. In fact, the Goldwater Revolution took place in 64. Many of Nixon's own people were deeply involved in the takeover of the party by the conservative wing of the party, the Reagan wing, the Goldwater wing, later the Reagan wing, and nominating Goldwater over the opposition of the entire Eastern establishment. Governor Dewey, President Eisenhower, the Scrantons, the Romneys, the New York Times, the New York Herald Tribune, all of whom had dominated the nomination since 1936, essentially with their internationalist neocon style candidates. So rather than run from Goldwater, as Rockefeller did, as Romney did, George Romney's the backstabbing father of Mitt Romney, governor of Michigan, Nixon decides to embrace Goldwater and hit the stump hard for Goldwater's election, kind of reestablishing his own conservative credentials as now he's not only the guy who nailed Alger Hiss as a communist spy, he's not only the man that communist mobs attacked and tried to kill in a limousine in Caracas, but he's also the man who stuck with us and fought for Barry when the chips were down and when all these elitist assholes from the country clubs with their green pants and their white wine headed for the high grass. And Goldwater Nixon profits from that. Many of the conservatives of the day, Bill Buckley, John Tower, Barry Goldwater, Strom Thurmond, they all support Nixon over Ronald Reagan for the nomination in 68. So, but my role in 68 is so peripheral in truth. I only got to shake hands with the great man one time in 1972. I met him once in 1968. Our relationship blossomed in 1977, and I became in almost literally daily contact with him until the time of his death, after he invited me to San Clemente for a visit after I had been elected successfully as chairman of the Republican National Federation. So he invited me, and before I got to San Clemente, Casa Pacifica, a very big and lonely looking house, and I went to his office, I noticed there was not a single thing on his desk. And he was clearly a man with not much to do. Mm-hmm. The aide who had ushered me in said, "Now the president's very busy. He may just give you a few moments, but he'll decide and he'll tell you when the meeting's concluded." I said, "Thank you." So we met and he was very friendly, gave me a presidential golf ball and a Nixon tie clip and so on. And then he said, this was 1977. He said, "Who will be the 1980 nominee? Surely," he says, "you agree John Connally will be nominated, former governor of Texas, former Democrat, Republican secretary of the treasury in Nixon's second term." And I said, "No, sir, Ronald Reagan will be the nominee." He said, "Really?" And I said, "Yes." And he said, "Can you stay for lunch?"
Wow.
And so we talked politics for almost 4 hours. I found him to be fascinating, but until he had a martini, which I would not experience until he moved to New York and I saw him there, he was not a loquacious fellow. He would like to talk about the future, not the past.
Right.
If he were alive today, he would say, "I love this guy, Matt Gaetz. He's got balls.
Gaetz, absolutely.
He likes fighters, you know, guys like, I don't know, Jim Jordan comes to mind.
Jim Jordan,
Lee Seldon, another guy with a lot of guts out on the island.
Yes.
You know, a fighter, a real fighter. There's a handful of these guys. I mean, people need to recognize that House Republicans is nowhere nearly monolithic. The majority of the House Republicans are what we refer to as rhinos, meaning they don't want to rock the boat. They want to get reelected. They want to be in the status quo.
Yep.
They're conservative on some things, and we bless them for that. But by and large, they have no interest to mix it up with the left and fight for principle within the formulation of public policy that we all have to live under. They're too quick to want to cut a deal.
Yeah.
There is no question that in the aftermath of Donald Trump's, the tape of him saying he would grab them by the female genitals, the so-called NBC tapes, there was a cabal that included Reince Priebus and Paul Ryan and Mike Pence to try to steal the nomination from Trump by convening a meeting of the Republican National Committee, formally unnominating Trump, which they have the power to do, and replacing him with Mike Pence. These were the Julius Caesars. These were the guys like the people around Julius Caesar. And unfortunately, Trump outwitted them, and the story narrative moved on quickly. Mike Pence was MIA for 3 days. Is that the man of character you want to be president?
Definitely not. He showed his character, and these weak-kneed rhino Republicans, like you talk about, the establishment. That's what they are. They're weak-kneed. What's the narrative? We're going with the flow. And then you have fighters like Matt Gaetz. I'm a big fan of Matt Gaetz. Jim Jordan. You have the I think he's the youngest congressman now, Madison Cawthorn.
He is an absolute star. Very, very impressive young man. Absolutely. I'm delighted that he beat Mark Meadows, handpicked candidate for that seat.
Absolutely. So, Nixon did some pretty extraordinary things as president. He desegregated colleges. He's done quite a few things that he doesn't get enough recognition for.
I think his record is extraordinary. He reached a strategic arms limitation with the Soviets.
Right.
He opened the door to China, but let's recognize the China he recognized, there were more oxen and carts than there were cars.
Right.
And he used them skillfully by playing their geopolitical interests across against the Soviets, because the Soviets knew that if they didn't give us a nuclear arms deal, their Chinese friends would, and then they would have an alliance that really scared them, because they have a shared border with China, and we do not.
Right.
Nixon then turns to Brezhnev and says, look, here's the deal. If you don't want to do it, that's fine. My new friend Mao Zedong invited me to come back on my way back home. It is the most skillful use of American diplomacy, and it saves us billions in defense spending. So, you know, because we're trying to move away from war. He desegregates the public schools without incidents or violence. Yes. He launches the war on cancer. He gives us federal revenue sharing, which for the first time, almost 80% of what you send to Washington is coming back to the state, and the state can spend it a hell of a lot better. Not that they don't misspend as well, but they can spend it better than some Coke bottle glasses wearing a bureaucrat in Washington, D.C., whose personal hero is Adlai Stevenson.
And he ended the Vietnam War. I mean, we.
The end of the Vietnam War, the end of the of the military draft, the 18-year-old pardon me, my associate has just stolen my ATM. it is extraordinary that he ends the draft, as I say, the 18-year-old vote, the enormous infusion of capital into the inner city. He sets up the Office of Minority Business Enterprise. He makes very low interest loans available to true minority-owned businesses, and he gives them landmarks in which they can work down their debt if they employ people in the inner city. He is very innovative in trying to use what he called black capitalism to because a rising tide lifts all boats. And in many of America's urban areas, you have magnificent architecture trapped in areas that are now slums. You have a homeless problem there. These places are potentially vibrant in terms of jobs and commerce and greater public safety when that comes. So Nixon put a great emphasis, working with Daniel Patrick Moynihan, a Nixon White House aide, later U.S. Democrat senator from New York.
Right.
But your Pat's widow would like us to forget that. on a solution for the cities. He was, over and above all, he was a peacemaker. So he had a deep trust. He was an establishment, but he had a deep distrust of the Central Intelligence Agency. He found out that the Joint Chiefs were spying on him early in his first term. So he was suspicious of Admiral Thomas Moorer. There was literally a Navy ensign going through Kissinger's briefcase at night, shooting documents and sending them back to the Pentagon. Because you see, the Pentagon boys, they wanted no part of this. What do you mean run down in Vietnam? Let us go in there and kick the shit out of them, Mr. President. We tried that under Johnson, and the bombing didn't work. They also didn't want this. Why are we going to cut a deal with the Chinks? They didn't want to go do something with Red China. So I'm doing my best Curtis LeMay impression there. these guys. So Nixon surprises the establishment. Kennedy surprises them because he beat Nixon from the right. Kennedy was a strong anti-communist. He proposed tax cuts and a military buildup in the 1960 campaign. He hit Nixon and Eisenhower for a missile gap that didn't exist between us and the Soviets, and he accused them for not being aggressive enough about Cuba and Castro when he'd been tipped about the secret Bay of Pigs plan that was classified. So it was a cheap shot. There was a plan, it's just that the plan sucked. Sucked so bad that Kennedy shouldn't have approved it when he got elected. In any event, there is, the whole Nixonian quality to it is pretty amazing.
So I wanted to, there's something that a lot of people don't know. I believe that a lot of people don't know. It came a point, I think, in the 90s that Nixon saw some potential in Donald Trump and wrote him a letter. Yes.
I had been working with Nixon. Pardon me, I've been working with Trump since 1981. In about 1989, I was still working for Trump. And I was also doing some work for Nixon on his scheduling and collecting political intelligence and doing an errand here and there, mostly going through mountains of invitations and sorting out those that I thought he should consider and those I thought he should pass on. I talked to him pretty much every day or every other day. So there was an occasion where Nixon and Trump were in George Steinbrenner's box at Yankee Stadium. And on the following day, Nixon called me and he was very enthused. "Well," he said, "I met your man. So really, what did you think?" "I'm telling you, he's got it. He could go all the way. And you know, I mean all the way." Of course, meant the presidency. And then he subsequently writes a letter to Trump telling him exactly that, and also mentioning that Mrs. Nixon had seen Trump on the Merv Douglas show, I guess, the Mike Douglas show, and thought the same thing. So it was a kind touch, but Nixon really is the first one who conceives of a President Donald Trump.
And obviously at that point, Donald Trump wasn't interested. We knew he wasn't interested back in the 80s when you had mentioned it to him.
Well, let me say this. He always had patriotic instincts. In other words, those who say all of his early flirtations with the presidency had to do with self-promotion and reading his name, that's bullshit. He saw as early as 88, he said, "Why are we getting killed in these trade negotiations? They send their smartest and brightest. We send bureaucrats who are trained as social workers to cut our business deals. We're getting taken to the cleaners." Secondarily, as early as 88, he's saying, "Look, I understand NATO. After World War II, we were wealthy and prosperous. They were decimated, so we helped defend them because they were our allies. But today, they are healthy, and we're struggling, and therefore, they should pay for their own defense. We can all stay together in NATO. Everybody just pays their fair share." Just the fact that he took that, they collected over $700 million from derelicts like France and Belgium, who aren't paying up, who are freeloaders and probably smoking those cigarettes with no filters.
And Donald Trump, he was good at calling everybody out who was not paying their fair share. We know that. And that's one of the great things he did in his presidency.
So none of these things were head fakes. He's always felt strongly about the direction of the country. I go back to an interview with Oprah where she says, "Yes. What about you, Donald? Would you ever run for public office? Would you ever run for the presidency?" He said, "No, I don't think so.
Yeah.
But unless things get so bad, in which case I have no choice." On another occasion, when he was asked by Chris Wallace, who used to be a pretty good guy, but now he's just a smart ass. The truth is, I liked Mike Wallace, who was a pretty straight guy. The apple has fallen far from the tree. Chris Wallace asks him, "Are you going to run for president?" Trump said, "No, I don't think so. But if I ran, I'd win."
Yes. Yes, he did. I remember that interview.
1988.
Yes. And, you know, he He would have. And if he anytime he decided he would want to get that nomination, he would have. He would have run and he would have won. I wanted to rewind a second back to Nixon because there was also something else, another point. He was a big supporter of Israel, the Yom Kippur War.
I think a case could be made he unilaterally saves Israel. Israel, under Golda Meir, is caught with an incredible intelligence failure, and they are hit unaware by a joint attack by the Egyptians and the Syrians, which they just didn't see coming. Their backs are against the sea, and they're running out of munitions. And Golda Meir appeals to Nixon directly for a lifeline. Nixon calls Admiral Thomas Moorer and General Alexander Haig and Dr. Kissinger. And in a meeting, he says, I want to fly them whatever lethal aid they need. And I want to get there as quickly as possible. So get with the Israelis and get their wish list. And they say, sir, it could cost $50 million. And Nixon says, I don't care if it costs $100 million. I want it out the door. Everybody secretly disagrees. Kissinger's against it. Mr. President, you will provoke the Russians. The Joint Chiefs are against it because they're worried about the Russians. Nixon waits a day, and Alexander Haig is in briefing him, and he says, General Haig, have my the stuff's been airlifted to Israel. When does it arrive? He says, actually, no, sir, it hasn't left the ground yet. This tape cannot be found. Funny how this is missing. He says, get me Admiral Moorer. Admiral Moorer on the line, sir. Nixon picks up the phone. He says, if this stuff is not on its way to Israel, he says, why is this stuff not on its way to Israel? And Moorer says, well, we haven't been able to choose the aircraft. And Nixon says, if it is not off the ground in 2 hours, in anything that can fly, I am personally coming over to the Pentagon to stick my foot up your ass. And he hangs up. Nixon could deduce that, you know, that Israel was our only ally in the region, and that the Russians were conspiring with those attacking them. And therefore, we had to come to the defense of an ally, because he understood people around the world were looking to see whether we would stand up for Israel as they had stood up for us. And had we not done so, the repercussions would have been far greater. So Nixon unilaterally saves Israel from annihilation. Now, in the White House tapes, there are certainly some places where he uses vernacular but very current derogatory terms towards Jews. And he also shrewdly and correctly in his political analysis and a lot of his late night musings realizes that the Jews in America are not in his voter base, shall we say. Right. But what matters, deeds or words? Those are words. No Israel, no Richard Nixon, no Israel.
Right. Deeds matter. Deeds are what's important. It's always important in everything. And you've said that in a lot of your speeches. I know you became very close with Nixon in the later years, like you said. You even learned his famous martini recipe, which I believe is called the silver bullet, right?
It is, and therefore I'm going to say it yet again for those of you who have not been paying attention. Because, Alan, I know you've had a few this past weekend. So, Nixon was very proud of his martini-making skills, and he was not a man who held his liquor well, and he knew it. Two drinks, and he was bombed. And he would take a bottle of olives, he would drain the olive juice, he would fill the bottle with water. Pete Santley. I apologize.
No worries.
And he would... he would then replace the cap. He would shake it. He would drain the water. Then he would fill the bottle with vermouth. He put it in the refrigerator until it was appropriately cold. Meanwhile, he had two martini glasses, or however many, in which he had run underwater and put into the freezer to chill. You would then take a silver cocktail shaker. Could be silver, could be aluminum. Here's the thing about cocktail shakers, if you have no experience using them, and that is, once you put the ice in them and whatever it is you're shaking, in this case, let's say gin or vodka, and you shake, sometimes the cap will expand so much from the cold that it is hard to remove. So in buying a cocktail shaker, you need to ensure you have one in which you can easily remove the cap. Now, you shake vigorously. I mean conga line stuff. The idea here is to make this so cold that the outside of the shaker stings your hands from the cold. Let that be a marker for you. That you then pour that into the chilled glass. And here's the tip to see whether you've done it right. There should be small shards of glass, like of ice, like glass on the surface. From the bottle, you retrieve two of Nixon's olives and you drop them in, and you have Dick Nixon's silver bullet. First time I sipped one, I said, "Mr. President, this is a great martini." He says, "I know. I got the recipe from Winston Churchill."
It just made me very, very, very thirsty, Roger. Made me very thirsty. So I want to end with something. Now, again, your book, Stone's Rules, which I loved, and I got to tell everybody, you got to get a copy of it. It's pretty amazing stuff in there, and you have some pretty interesting rules. I wanted to talk about one before I let you go, and it's in the book. It's rule number 8: if life is a performance, be a costume. And I know from seeing your appearances and whatnot, you really live that up. Tell us, just life is a performance. You know,
the great starlet Marlene Dietrich always controlled her own lighting. No matter on the public appearance or the photo shoot or the movie. The point is that all communications today is entertainment, and all entertainment is visual, and therefore video far more important than print used to be. And therefore you should always make an attempt to look your best. It doesn't always mean, as you can see, wearing a tie, a fancy suit and tie, which I do most of the time, but it does matter. It does mean wearing a jaunty Panama hat that your grandfather would cherish. The point is, I think you've got to give some thought to how you look, because how you look is how you present yourself to the world in anything you're trying to do. It's one thing to be home alone and sitting in your shorts and T-shirt, typing on the internet. I can picture Donald Trump doing that, can't you?
Sure.
That's one thing. But I'm talking about, in public and on video, how you look in the visual is very important. So, for example, that shirt you're wearing today is a good-looking shirt that doesn't clash with, I think, is a very cool background. You can look at your background and you already know what this show is about. That's what I love about it.
Well, we'll be candid with everybody. I didn't start out with this shirt. I got some fashion sense today from Roger Stone. So I was wearing a plaid button-up shirt. And before we started, Roger said, "Yeah, maybe a solid color shirt would be
I'm
better."
I'm not sure if you could hear that lightning, but it sounds to me like God didn't like your shirt either. So
is that what that was? That was thunder out there.
That's what that was. Let me suggest ritually, guys, to the folks in the control room, take that shirt out immediately after this and burn it.
I'm going to have to do that now. Fashion advice from Roger Stone. When he tells you to burn a shirt, you burn a shirt. You don't fuck around. You got to burn the shirt. Roger, listen, I appreciate you being here with me. This is one of 4 parts that we're doing uncensored, up close and personal with the Roger Stone. It's amazing to have your time and to listen to your experience in the life of politics, because I tell everybody you are an American political icon.
Well, you're very kind to say that. Now, tell me what city you are broadcasting from.
I'm on Long Island. I'm in New York. I'm in Nassau County.
You're in Nassau County, which of course is the home of the famous Margiotta machine. Chairman Joe Margiotta, a very close friend of mine, close friend of President Trump's. A close friend of President Reagan's, a good man, a man who, in my opinion, was railroaded because the Republican organization in Nassau posed such a threat. But I know Nassau well. I know every square inch of it. So I have many, many friends out there. You know, I love that you are right there in Nassau County. One of my prized possessions is a framed ticket to President Richard Nixon's reelection rally at the Nassau Coliseum, where he was brought into town by Chairman Joe Margiotta, a very close friend of mine, served in the state legislature, a great man, a great Republican, a man who was attacked for political purposes, but Joe Margiotta did nothing wrong. Look, I have many friends there in Nassau County. I also have a few folks I'm not really fond of. I'm not going to mention any names. Alphonse D'Amato. Alphonse is with Obama and the Clintons and Soros and his cabal. What did I tell you? In any event, some of the greatest Italian food in all of America right there in Nassau County. So I salute my many friends there. I have many, many out there on the island, fine American patriots.
It's not a bad place. I love Long Island. Roger, listen, again, I want to thank you again. We're going to pick this up on another part where we're going to probably dive into the Watergate scandal in the next episode. I want everyone out there to go. It's going to be in the show notes. Roger Stone's website's going to be in there. You got to get Stone's Rules. That there's other books there that are unbelievable. We're going to go through them as the episodes continue. Roger,
we've just come across some new archives from that Watergate period that I think could be fascinating to put on screen for our next parlay. So we'll get you some of that stuff. The stunning truth of Watergate must be told.
Yes,
John Dean is the weasel. Right now, go to WatergateWeasel.com, WatergateWeasel.com. And in our next show, we'll tell you the truth about Watergate. We'll tell you the truth about the pardon. We'll tell you about who planned, pushed, protected, and lied about and hushed up the Watergate break-in. But we'll also talk about ultimately Gerald Ford and the pardon that saved Richard Nixon's life. Coming up on our next show at The Great Divide.
Can't wait, Roger. Thank you so much. Yes, be sure to tune in next episode, The Great Divide Podcast. Go to the website, thegreatdivide1776.com. Get all the episodes there. Until next time on the next episode of Uncensored, Up Close and Personal with Roger Stone. Remember, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and most of all, God bless America. Take care, everybody. Thank you. You can reach out to me with opinions and ideas for other episodes at TheGreatDivide1776@gmail.com. You can also find me on social media at The Great Divide Podcast. And please be sure to leave a review for this podcast so the show can be shared to other listeners. Thank you, and God bless America.